Tom Woods Show, episode 2172.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. As promised, the great Dominic Frisby is with us today. And how do you even sum up Dominic Frisby? How do you define this guy? How do you describe who he is and what he does? Because he does so many things. He's a financial commentator. He's a Bitcoin guy. He's a stand-up comedian. He's a voiceover guy. He is, as you'll see today, he's produced something creative that is of very high quality and very great importance. He's a content creator. He is a defender of freedom. He is a tremendous writer and communicator. He's just a charming guy, just the kind of guy you want to have dinner with. A tremendous, tremendous guy. So glad I've gotten to know him over the past few years. And he does have something very, very special to share with us. And we're going to get to that a little bit later, but I want to start off with a discussion of madness in the UK, madness in the US. Let's see who's ahead, let's say, in that category. Dom, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much, Tom. Pleasure to talk to you.
It's great to have you back, and I'm so happy to hear about your new project, which I want to talk about in a few minutes. But fill us in what's going on over in your crazy part of the world. I mean, as an American, I have no right to call any place else crazy. But what do you make of Boris Johnson being gone and the motivations behind that? And what do you have in his place?
Well, I'm not sure how manipulated by the media I am, Tom, but I never really bought into the sort of craziness, the pro-Boris craziness when he got elected in 2019. And he was elected with one of the biggest majorities in 20 or 30 years. And the reason he was elected was because he unified a lot of people in one single desire, which was to get Brexit done and get it done properly. And that's why he was elected. And so, you know, there was a lot of people on the left who had voted for Brexit, and their way of making sure it happened was to vote for Boris. So he got a lot of votes that way. And then Brexit sort of half got done, but then it just completely disappeared because of COVID. And it was just eclipsed by COVID. As I say, I don't know if I was being manipulated, but I just found myself getting more and more wound up. I just thought he was a fraud and a fake, and you know, he's quite an entertaining journalist every now and then, but should this guy really be the prime minister? And then I didn't like the way that we reacted to COVID. He wanted to lock us down again, and that stopped. I think he got COVID himself quite badly. And so that affected his judgment for a bit. He got rid of his key advisor, Dominic Cummings, who's probably a bit of a psychopath, the ex from hell. And after he sacked Cummings, Cummings was determined to get rid of Boris and now takes the credit for having got rid of him. And he started listening to his wife, who's very much in that sort of touchy-feely, green, metropolitan, liberal elite thing, that one of the reasons we voted Brexit was to put an end to that kind of nonsense. So I think the underlying problem is that I remember meeting Nigel Farage once, and well, I've met him many times, but this was on the night that we left the European Union and we were both doing a show together. And I was saying what the problem with Theresa May was, the previous prime minister, is that she didn't stand for anything. And so she was wishy-washy, and she'd do one thing one way one day, and then she'd do one thing another day the next. And there was no sort of core philosophy. And Farage said to me, first principles. That's what Thatcher used to talk about all the time, first principles. And it's when you don't know what to do in a situation, when you're unsure, you fall back on your guiding philosophy, and that's what helps you make decisions. And I think, not unlike Theresa May, Boris basically at the end of the day had no first principles. Anyway, we've got rid of him, and now we've got two useless people fighting it out, neither of whom anyone wants.
Ah, yes, the story of the world.
Yeah, it's like a choice between Joe Biden and Kamala Harris.
Yeah, which is, the Democrats are desperate to find a third option at this point. So, yeah. Well, you know, it's so funny that it seems as if a legitimate, plausible substitute for them is, now I don't know in the UK how well you know American governors, but is Gavin Newsom of California, who was maybe the worst on COVID of all the governors. I mean, instead of being run out of town, he's considered to be a very plausible nominee possibility for 2024.
But isn't like he, you know, a huge part, or you know, his policies a huge part of the reason why there's this massive exodus from California?
I'm no doubt about it. And yet for some reason, he's charismatic, he's telegenic, so he's got all the superficial qualities that you'd be looking for. And, you know, for the people who hysterically went in for the COVID nonsense, he's their poster child. And
does he say, end of quote, repeat the line?
He doesn't say that. So he's yet another improvement. He knows how to read his speech. So we'll see. Let me ask you, I know you're not, I read something you wrote saying that you haven't really been a huge fan of stage performances, theater, for some time. But you and I still are interested in culture. And of course, you do various kinds of performances yourself. So I'd like to compare what's going on right now on Broadway with the West End, because I'm in New York City right now.
Okay.
And this afternoon, I'm going to a performance after we finish talking. And up till this week, I haven't been to one in over 2 years because I'm not going to show vax papers to get into a play, for heaven's sake. Which I don't have those papers, but also I am not wearing a mask during the entire performance. And it's legendary at this point, Dom, the way they enforce the masks in the theaters. They've got somebody holding a sign, mask up. They're monitoring everybody. They come to your seat and harass you if they think you've taken too long of a sip. The whole thing's ridiculous. If these things really worked that well, they wouldn't let you take a sip. You know, they would just say, you can survive 2.5 hours without a sip of anything. So the whole thing's crazy. I'm not going to do that. But then July 1st, they said, it's optional now to wear masks. And the reason they said that wasn't that they looked through the data and they said, masks don't seem to be as effective as we thought. Maybe we oversold them. It's that the thing that's not being oversold is Broadway tickets. Yeah. And they thought, anything we can do to get more seats in these theaters, we will do. So they've done that, but it seems still to have done massive damage to Broadway. You got shows closing prematurely. You got other shows not having as many performances as before. So they're trying to say, look, the audiences are full. They're desperate to give that impression. Yeah, but they've had massive discounts. They've cut back on the number of performances, all these sorts of things. What's the status over there to the extent you know it?
Well, I can tell you a couple of little anecdotes. It's funny, masks, they're a bit like pronouns. They've become like a symbol of your political leanings. Not always, but a lot of the time. And we're definitely more lax about masks in the UK than you are in the States. Like pretty much nobody here wears them ever at all, except you occasionally see some people on the tubes wearing them, usually tourists. That all, funnily enough, started last December with Boris. He was going to lock us down again. And a load of backbench MPs basically said, this is the on the right of the Conservative Party, the Libertarians in the Conservative Party, basically said, if you lock us down again, we're doing a vote of no confidence in you. And so Boris was like, okay, we're not locking down. And masks no longer became mandatory. And do you know what? Our COVID rates were no different to anywhere else in the world. In fact, if anything, they were slightly better. So the conclusion you would draw from that is that masks don't make a great deal of difference. And so we didn't go into a lockdown last December. We stopped wearing masks. Everyone, you know, the English way is the sort of hypocritical way. The law says one thing and everybody does everything else. And then they sort of rewrite the law to suit what everyone's actually doing and pretend they didn't make the law in the first place. And so
I wish we had that in the US. That sounds like a wonderful way to live.
Well, it's sort of just sort of this hypocrisy, but everyone sort of accepts it. But anyway, so I remember going to France skiing. They were arresting people in the cable car for not wearing masks. And you're like, you're up a mountain, you can't get it. but this sort of pretending COVID never really happened policy sort of spread from us. And I'm surprised. I still see like Kamala Harris and people, Biden and stuff, wearing masks. And I look at that and I go, what are you doing? But it's almost become like it's a virtue statement. And that kind of left of center mentality we rail against, slightly authoritarian left, although they would never call themselves that. They think they're freedom-loving. But that left of centre mentality occupies British culture. So the BBC is like that, and I'm afraid musical theatre is like that. So even after many months of that, I went to see The Book of Mormon, And this was the amazing thing. The Book of Mormon, I saw it 3 or 4 months ago, shortly after things had opened up properly. I went on the internet on the Wednesday and I got tickets, plum tickets in the stalls on that Friday. Now, before COVID, I would have had to book 3 months in advance or something.
Yeah.
So, and that's the Book of Mormon, which I just think is great. It's really good. I thought it was just one of the best things I've ever seen. I didn't expect it to be anything like as good. I was reluctant to see it for various reasons because I just thought it was going to be patronizing, but it was excellent. Anyway, now I think things have got a bit busier still, but, you know, the West End isn't anything like as busy. And Book of Mormon is comedy. And still everyone was covered in masks. And so they said, you don't have to wear a mask, but we would like you to. And this is after, you know, Britain's pretty much freed itself up. Even in the theatres, you know, I would say it was about 50-50, people wearing masks and people not. And people were giving me dirty looks for not wearing masks. But like, if you're on stage and you're performing a comedy and you can't hear the laughs because the audience have all got masks on and you can't even see if they're smiling or not, that's pretty hard to perform. So you were supposed to be coming to the West End this week and you couldn't make it and you've given me your ticket. So I'm off to see Les Mis tonight.
That's awesome. And I think they're pretty good seats, by the way, as I recall.
I'll say middle of the front row, mate.
Is that what they were? Yeah. Doggone. Well, I wanted somebody to enjoy them. I'm glad you will.
I forgot how much you love musicals, and I've been working on this other musical project. And by the way, the main guy in this other musical project that we'll talk about in a second was the lead, Valjean, in Les Mis for the longest ever time, which is kind of cool. So there's a nice bit of crossover there. John Owen Jones is his name. But my suspicion is that the West End is struggling. There are far fewer tourists. Well, I mean, no, I say that. Every time I go to the West End, it's mobbed. But I think tourists are down a little bit on what they were. I do know some shows are struggling, but it's the West End, so it's always going to be pretty busy. But, you know, like Broadway, producers like a pound note and they will do whatever it takes to get one. And if that means making masks voluntary, then they'll do that.
Right. You know, I'll just say one more thing before we get into what you've been up to. I spent just about a week in Stockholm a couple of months ago for the first time ever. And it's impossible. I really consider it impossible not to love that place. I don't see how you could. I don't understand what your complaint could be. Maybe you don't like the politics, but that's going to be true of every city you visit, unfortunately, but almost all of them. But it really is true that nobody's wearing masks. I mean, you see 1 out of 1,000, and almost all of those are American tourists.
Yeah, well, I was going to say tourists from Hong Kong or something.
Yeah, something, right. But then, so I walked down the street in New York City where it seems like there are more masks now than there were in April when I was here. I want to pull them aside and say, so what are you thinking about the fact that in Scandinavia, they're just not wearing these and it makes absolutely no difference? I mean, why does that not change your perspective on this? Are they all wrong? Do you think they're all secretly dying and not reporting it? I mean, why are you acting like this? But, you know, and the thing is, I think I'm just more excitable than other people. I was so upset about this that every time I see somebody wearing this outside for no reason at all, I feel like they are in some way complicit in all this.
Well, it ends up becoming a political argument. You know, masks have been politicized. I just pray that there's something that left in the world that doesn't get politicized, but masks have been politicized. And there's some really good videos doing the rounds on the internet of people vaping while wearing masks. And so you can see the smoke and you realize just how totally ineffective they are when you can actually see the vapor.
Right.
You know,
right.
They just don't work.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about something happier, which is, you know, you're a really, really productive guy and you do a lot of great stuff. And I'm so glad, you know, I wrote to you about these tickets that I had and it was just a nice, happy accident that I wrote to you at what turned out to be a very important time for you creatively because of this project. And I watched the video you made about it, explaining what the plot of it is, let's say. First of all, anybody who's interested in history will love it, but also anyone who's just interested in the human experience and the trials we endure and what we make of them is going to find this quite stunning. It involves your own family. So give us the background.
Okay, so there's a lot of background, but I'll try and cut to the chase. And I think, like you say, this is a happy accident. It's a bit of serendipity going on. So my dad was a very famous playwright, or quite famous playwright. He wrote a play called There's a Girl in My Suit, which was a big hit in Broadway and in the West End, became a film with Peter Sellers and Goldie Hawn. And he always regarded the best thing he ever wrote, this thing called Kisses on a Postcard, which was the story of his time as a seven-year-old boy in World War II. Now, in World War II, all the cities in England got bombed. And so they had the massive evacuation. I think it was like 6 million children were evacuated from their families in the cities to the countryside. And so my dad was seven, his brother was 11. And the two of them were sent from their mum and dad. Nobody had any idea where they were going. It was like a wholesale breaking apart of families across the country. Something pretty similar just happened in Ukraine. And dad was sent off from southeast London to Cornwall, which is the equivalent of being sent from, I don't know, New York to the very southern tip of Florida or something like that, to some, you know, really distant remote place, somewhere in the middle of Oklahoma or something. It was just him and his brother, and they were put on the train, and then they arrived in this little village, and then they were just picked out at random by people in the village, and dad ended up spending the whole of World War II there, from the age of 7 through to 11. And he calls it his second childhood. And he'd been always trying to get this thing made, and there was community theatre productions done and this, that, and the other, but he never got to see it in the West End or on stage. And when the lockdown happened, just before the lockdown, dad died. And I was going through stuff and I found this script. And I took it home and I just put it on my shelf. And it was like every day I'd be at my desk and the script would just look up at me and catch my eye like a sort of dog wanting to go for a walk or something. And in the end, I thought, look, I've got to make this happen. And I have a sideline writing songs. And the guy I write comic songs with, turned out his dad had also been evacuated to Cornwall. So we rewrote a load of the music. I didn't have the means to turn it into a film because that would mean, you know, I'd need $10 million or something and powerful allies. The West End was locked down. I didn't have the option to turn it into a thing. So I turned it into a stage show. So I did an audio adaptation of the story. It's available as a podcast, or you can buy the CD, or you can buy it on Bandcamp. And it's 4 hours. It's no small undertaking. It's 4 hours long. But as I say, it's got the two leads from Les Mis, Katie Seacombe and John Owen Jones, all sorts of other well-known stars from the UK. And here's a good story for you. You'll like this. It's got a cast of over 50 and an orchestra of 15. And we were due to record it in this studio during the lockdown. And the studio started totally breaking my balls about COVID. The musicians have got to wear masks. Everyone's got to be 2 meters apart. And I'm like, the studio's not big enough. And nobody's got COVID. Everyone's done the test. And how can a musician wear a mask if they're playing the clarinet or something? You know, they were just being absolutely absurd. And so I just, on a whim, I phoned up a load of other studios in London. And the first one I phoned up was Abbey Road, the famous studios where the Beatles did all their stuff. And I said, look, we need a studio at the last minute. And they said, well, funnily enough, we've got this orchestra that's due in tomorrow. And the directors had to go into quarantine for 2 weeks because he's come over from France, the conductor. So the studio's now free. So we'll give it to you at cost. So we recorded the whole thing in Abbey Road. So, you know, that was a hell of a coup for us. And yes, so that's the story of how it came about. And I've got this thing and I'm now just telling as many people as possible about it to try and get as many people to listen.
I hear you. First of all, the Abbey Road story, that really is great. What a wonderful thing. But, well, first of all, we're going to play a couple of the songs. Let's set one of them up now, and okay, then I want to ask a little bit more about some aspects of the story. So which one do you want to start with?
Well, I'll start with the first one, Kisses on a Postcard. And this song explains why it's called Kisses on a Postcard. There's a bit of a story here. So as I said, Dad was seven and his brother was 11. They didn't know where they were going, who was going to be taking them in, how long they were going to be staying for. And you can imagine if you're a parent just saying goodbye to your kids, you don't know if it's the last time you'll ever see them. But their mum, my grandma, turned it into an adventure for them. And what she did is she gave them a postcard and she said, when you get there, and they're like, where? And she said, where you're going. I want you to write...
By the way, that's a typical mother response,
yeah,
isn't it?
Exactly, 100%. Yeah. She said, you write the address on this postcard, and then the postcard had on it, Dear Mum and Dad, arrived safe and well, love Jack and Terry. Jack and Terry are my dad and his brother. And then she said, if it's horrible, you put one kiss on the postcard, and I'll come straight down there and get you. If it's okay, you put two kisses, and if it's really nice, you put three kisses. So there was a secret code for them. And so they say goodbye to their parents, hundreds of parents saying goodbye to their kids on the train. They're stuck on the train. They have this 5-6 hour train journey down to Cornwall. They're herded into the village hall, selected like cattle in a cattle market. They're chosen by this weird Welsh couple. They're taken back to their house and they arrived at this tiny house, horrible, tiny little cottage at the end of a row of cottages. And they go in, there's oil lamps, no electricity. There's a cat asleep by the hearth. There's a canary in a cage. They go in the garden. There's a pig in the yard. There are chickens. Then they look outside in the garden and there's the railway at the end of their garden. They loved trains. And then they looked out into the valley and there were woods with rivers to dam and hills to climb and quarries to explore. And they thought they'd died and gone to heaven. And so this first song that I'm about to play now takes place on their first night, and they're discussing how many kisses to put on the postcard.
How many kisses?
I vote 3.
What would Mum and Dad think of it here?
Don't know.
No electricity. They wouldn't like that.
I don't care.
There's no bathroom.
I don't care.
Outside love, all they have. I can't go in an outside love.
I don't mind. I don't care.
What if it's freezing cold out there?
That's what the pot's for, don't you see?
I vote 1.
I vote 3.
To share, all squashed up in it.
I don't care.
Kisses on a postcard, we must write something we've got to do tonight. Kisses on a postcard, what'll they show? Only Mum is going to know.
What about Gwyn?
Gwyn's not bad, even though you can see he's mad.
Auntie Rose, what do you say?
She says weird things, but she's okay. Not Uncle Jack, though, he plays rough. Pulled my hair, called me scruff.
Kisses on a postcard, what do we do?
I still say 3.
Well, I say 2. Kisses on a postcard, 3, 2, 1. Better be quick or it won't get done.
If we put less than 3, Mum and Dad will think it's rotten here. They'll be worried.
Yeah, well, there's the trains, they're good.
And the station, right next to us.
That's terrific.
Hey, wait, I've just remembered. Hens.
What about hens?
Eggs, stupid. Real eggs. Not that horrible powdery stuff.
Eggs for you, eggs for me. Eggs for breakfast, supper and tea. Poached or baked, scrambled or fried.
Or boiled with soldiers on the side.
What do you say now, what's your score?
Why not?
Mum only set up to 3.
But don't you see? The more kisses we put, the more happy they're going to be.
Yeah, it's terrific here, really, isn't it? Like being on holiday, only there's no sea.
We don't have to stop at 4. Let's do hundreds!
Yeah!
Kisses on a postcard, one by one. All round the edges, this is fun. Kisses on a postcard, squashed up tight. Telling Mum that we're all right.
You know, after this COVID thing, where we still have some parents insisting on kids wearing masks, I think, oh, gosh, what are these kids going to be like when they grow up? Are they going to be neurotic? Are they going to rebel against their parents and say, why did you make me do this useless thing? I don't know, but it worries me. But then I think about, look at what a lot of these kids endured during World War II. And most of them...
They had gas masks. They really did need masks.
Yeah, yeah. And they actually turned out okay, by and large. You know, which is nice to hear. But I mean, this went on for quite some time. I mean, surely at some point, Dad becomes homesick.
Well, he must have done. And I think the parents, they did come down at times during the war to see them because there are pictures of the parents down there. But in the story, we sort of adapted it a bit. In the story, it's kind of more dramatic if they're separated from their parents. And, you know, they just had a label on with their name on it. That was all, you know, there wasn't mobile. You can text home, say, I'm all right. So, you know, we forget how lucky we are living in the time and place that we do today with all the technology and everything else at our disposal. And I think our ancestors were a heck of a lot tougher than we are. And sometimes, you know, I look at what's going on and I just think, oh, come on, man up. to use that song in Book of Mormon. But, you know, we really just, you know, to just pull our socks up and grow a pair, as we say here.
Did your father ever talk to you about this experience?
He did, all the time. And we went down to the cottage and, you know, he said they used to fight all the time, the Vakis kids and the local kids. And the Vakis kids, you know, they were all city, streetwise city kids. And if they played them at football, they'd win like 20-0. If they played them at cricket, they'd destroy them. They even cheated better, is one of the phrases from the play. And so the local kids must have resented the Vakis just as much as the Vakis hated being where they were. And there were people who never saw their parents again. There were families destroyed by it. But there were also people who had happy experiences. And I'm glad to say Dad was one of the people that had a happy experience down there. And he talked about it, yeah, all his life. He never stopped talking about it.
What is the next song? What's the context of it?
Well, you see the whole of the story of World War II through the perspective of this tiny Cornish village. And so, you know, the evacuation of Dunkirk, the evacuation of the Vakis kids, the invasion of Southern Europe. And then prior to D-Day, the D-Day landings, the Normandy landings, all the Americans arrived in the UK. And so different regiments would be billeted on different villages. And Dad swears, I always thought he made this up, but we've since investigated and we found out that it was true, that the first regiment that was billeted on his village in Cornwall, in this tiny village in Cornwall, the first regiment was a regiment from Louisiana. And it was all black guys. And it was one of the few only black residents. Now, you know, people in that village in Cornwall had never, you know, the English were foreigners and Americans may have been from Mars, but black Americans, they'd never seen them before. And so that was terribly exciting. And it's a great moment in the musical because we have it so they bring all their Southern US music with them. And so this whole regiment of black GIs is billeted on the village. And there's a famous thing, the GI brides, many of the local girls fell in love with American soldiers. And sometimes, you know, they were left unmarried mums and all of that. And sometimes they ended up marrying them and going off to the States. But anyway, there was this one girl who Dad became very friendly with. She taught him the facts of life. And we've sort of exaggerated her character a little bit. But she has numerous affairs with the soldiers prior to D-Day and then becomes pregnant by one of them. And she has to be sent off to a home for unmarried mothers. And as it turned out, the family that took Dad in when Dad left, they actually took her and her kid in. So she never went to one of these homes for unmarried mothers, but they sprung up all across the country. But in any case, this is a song in a sort of dream sequence. And this is a song that she sings about what she wants to happen to her.
My mum ran off with a jolly Jack Tar and left me all at sea. This forgotten part of England has been a cage to me. I want to see the world. I want to get away. I would love somebody to love me. So every night I pray. I want to be a GI bride. I want to travel far and wide. We'll live without a care. The folk will stop and stare. I want to be a GI bride. I want to wed a swell GI. I want to kiss this place goodbye. We'll be so glamorous and oh so amorous. I want to be a GI bride. He'll say gee whiz, have slicked back hair. He'll buy me fancy clothes and nylon underwear. We'll dance the jitterbug and do the Susie Q. We'll have a big white house and some children too. I want to be a GI bride. Before you know, we'll be stateside. We'll make such a splash as we spend all our cash. I want to be a GI bride. return. But now they're gone away. Oh, I hope that one will come for me. And this is what he'll say.
Will you be my GI bride? And to the altar let us ride. I know the sun will shine and you will look divine. So will you be my GI bride?
Well, I could be your swell GI, and to America we'd fly. The world would be so fine when you at last are mine. So will you be my GI bride?
We'll watch baseball and eat French fries.
I'll take you to my mom
to eat her apple pie.
We'll drink root beer.
We'll travel far.
We'll go to Coney Island
in our motor car. I wanna be a GI bride, and then together we'll be tied. At some point you'll see they will come back for me, and then I really must decide. It doesn't matter who I marry, be it Don or Slick or Larry. I only want to be a GI bride.
Tell people how they can get hold of this. I mean, again, this is a labor of love for you, but it's also a labor of a lot of money. So let's see what we can do to get people listening. What's the easiest way for them to do that?
Well, the website is kissesonapostcard.com. And, you know, people think I've done this out of some sort of homage to my dad, but I have. But the real reason I've done this is because it's brilliant and it has the potential to be one of the greatest musicals of all time, up there with Oliver and The Sound of Music and whatever else. It's that good. And I looked at it and I just thought, I cannot let this be just a script and a CD sitting on a shelf. So even though I've invested a lot of money and I've invested years of my time on it, I've done it. I wouldn't have done it if it was rubbish. You know, I've done it because I think it's brilliant. And yes, you can buy the CD at kissesonapostcard.com, or you can get the CD at kissesonapostcard.bandcamp.com. But it's also available for free as a podcast. And you can find the link to the podcast at kissesonapostcard.com, either Android or Apple Podcasts. I've made it available for free because I just want as many people as possible to listen to this fantastic story. As I say, it's 4 hours long, so you treat it a bit like an audio book. Listen to it in half-hour intervals. But Kisses on a Postcard is where you want to go. And if you want to buy the CD, I do ship to the US.
All right, well, that's good to hear, too. I hope people will support you. Let me just tell everybody, unambiguously, Dom Frisbee is one of the good guys, okay? He is unambiguously one of the good guys. Now, that, strictly speaking, shouldn't matter if he's produce something of good quality. You want to support something of good quality, but you also want to support a darn good guy who's sometimes taken some unpopular stands that haven't won him a lot of fans in, you know, let's say certain circles, but he's done it because it's the right thing to do. So let's do right by him by supporting him with Kisses on a Postcard. And now, is the hope that, I mean, of course you want a lot of people to listen to it, but that maybe, is there some lingering thought that there's a possibility the right person could hear it?
Yeah.
And says, maybe we should do this with it.
That's the dream. And, you know, John Owen Jones, who plays the lead, who, as I said, was the longest ever running, the most popular Valjean in Les Mis of all time. One of the things he said to me is, Les Mis, Jesus Christ Superstar, they all started as concept albums. And what this effectively is a concept album. And he said, even if you were doing it as a West End project or something, I would tell you to do it as a concept album first. And great things begin this way. And so, yes, I'm hoping that Mr. Johnny Big Gun producer at Netflix listens to it. I'm hoping that, you know, Cameron McIntosh or whoever the biggest producer is on Broadway, I'm hoping all these guys stumble across it and fall in love with it. Because everyone who listens to it falls in love with it.
Wow. Okay. So kissesonapostcard.com. is where to go. I'm also linking to it on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/2172. Well, I'm hopeful that before the year is out, I will be in London, would love to share a meal. And certainly by that time, I will have listened to the whole thing. I just talked to you this week. I didn't have time to do it because I'm sort of on vacation, but without a doubt, I will listen to it myself and I will look forward to seeing you.
Next time you're on a long car journey, that's a good time to listen to it.
By the way, I have a number of those because even though Orlando's airport flies a lot of places directly, for international flights, it's actually better oftentimes to fly out of Miami, especially if I'm going to the UK. Mm-hmm. So I have, that's a long drive. That's 2.5 to 3 hours. So between there and back, the whole thing is consumed. So that will be happening. I'm heading to Scotland, actually, at the end of next month.
Oh, so, brilliant.
Yeah, I've never been there. So on the way to the, we'll be flying out of Miami. So we will be listening.
I think that's one of the reasons why podcasts have got so big, especially long podcasts in the States, is because you just drive a lot. You're in your car a lot, and it's a great thing to do in the car.
Yeah, that must be it, because I cannot generally understand the appeal of three-hour podcast episodes. I don't understand that, but yet apparently millions of people love them. So, you know, to each his own, I guess. But this is my opportunity to have an extended listen to something, and I very much look forward to it. So best of luck with it, Dominic Frisbee. We appreciate you.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, friends, that is going to do it for this week. Next week, we kick it off with Tom Mullen. We're going to talk about what did Thomas Jefferson really mean by all men are created equal. We're going to talk about that. And if you like and appreciate what goes on here at the Tom Woods Show, then consider becoming a supporting listener, because man, do I give you a lot of goodies as a thank you, a sincere thank you for helping to make this show possible. Head over to supportinglisteners.com, check out all the goodies, and I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.